This is Monday, February 11th, 2013. This is the Committee on Health and Human Services and Housing. Good afternoon. We have a series of bills to be heard today. We're going to begin with a hearing from Senate File 39, Senator Rosen. A quorum is present.
Thank you, Senator Rosen. Thank you, Madam Chair. We have heard this bill and a couple weeks, or last week, I believe it was. It's a community paramedic bill, and this is the third year of it. So at first, though, I would like to make a motion to take this bill off the table, please.
It's been moved that Senate File 39 be pulled from the table. Is there any further discussion on that motion? Seeing none, all those in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Senator Rosen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I believe, Madam Chair, in your packets, you have the A1 amendment, and this is a very simple amendment. So actually, it's good that we're pulling this off the table because I believe that you'd like to have this bill sent to the floor, but there is a change in some wording, just clarifying language on the renewable requirements for a community paramedic. So we're stating page 1, line 6 of the amendment that their renewable requirements have to be above and beyond what they already have. So it's 12 hours more of the 300 hours, and they have to do that every 2 years. So we're just basically clarifying the renewable requirements in the bill, and I think that would pretty much suffices the entire amendment.
Senator Rosen moves Amendment A1 to Senate File 39. Any discussion? All those in favor? Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so with that, I would ask that Senate File 39, the community paramedic, be recommended to pass and sent straight to the floor.
Senator Rosen has made her motion. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Hearing none, goes to the floor.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you very much, members.
Senator Hayden.
Good morning, Madam Chair.
Good morning. Thank you, Senator Hayden, for joining us. And remember, I do recollect you're saying that you were never going to disagree with the chair the last committee hearing. I do remember that's fixed. I don't remember much, but that I've got
that
firmly
remember,
fixed.
Madam Chair.
Yes.
Well, absolutely, especially when I'm in front of you presenting a bill, I most certainly will always agree with you. Well, Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 147, and I think its next stop would be Finance.
Would you like to go over the bill and describe the bill to the committee?
Absolutely. Madam Chair and members, Senate File 147 is a bill for Hennepin County's pilot project by the name of Hennepin Health. On January 1st, 2012, the county launched an integrated healthcare system, an integrated healthcare delivery network specifically designed to serve some of its most challenging and costly residents in our county's safety net population. Focused on single adults without minor children, whose income is at or below 75% of the federal poverty guidelines, the county brought together the county's own health plan, Metropolitan Health Plan, the Safety Net Hospitals, HEMC, and its clinics, North Point Wellness Center in North Minneapolis, and the county's Human Service and Public Health Department to improve health outcomes and lower the total cost of care for providing care and wraparound services to this population. There are three people here today who can add more detail about this pilot, but the bill asks for an exemption of the mandatory copayments imposed on the pilot enrollees. Most of the pilot enrollees have such low incomes that they are not actually required to pay copayments, but the pilot must perform all the documentation to verify that the fact that every month and incur administrative costs. This bill would recognize that the pilot will absorb any value of copayments, so there will be no fiscal impact to the state's general fund. The three people here today are Karen Strum, Acting CEO of Minnesota Health Plan, Ross Owen, Manager of Hennepin Health, and Brian Bergs, CFO for North Point Health and Wellness. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Karen Strum is here to testify. Ross Owen, you can come to the table as well. Thank you.
Would you like to start?
Madam Chair, if it's all right with you, I'd like to begin by making a general overview of the Hennepin Health Program and then pass over to my colleagues for some additional detail.
Absolutely. Please identify yourself by giving your name for the record.
For the record, my name is Ross Owen. I'm the product manager for the Hennepin County Demonstration Project, Hennepin Health. As Senator Hayden stated very well, Hennepin Health is an accountable care partnership between Hennepin County Medical Center, North Point Health and Wellness Clinic, Metropolitan Health Plan, and the county's Human Services and Public Health Department. And together, those county entities jointly contract with the Minnesota Department of Human Services to serve roughly 6,000 enrollees, all part of the Medicaid early expansion population. The goal of Hennepin Health broadly is really to integrate healthcare and social services and to create incentives for those partners to work together in new and more efficient ways across silos so that we can reduce the total cost of care while improving health outcomes. A couple of unique features of Hennepin Health that I want to draw your attention to this afternoon. The first is the population served. As we said, they're adults without children, all earning less than 75% of the federal poverty level. And these are folks that have often not historically had strong links to the healthcare system. And what we've experienced in the first parts of Hennepin Health are that the work is really to create those bonds, to create those relationships, and to change a pattern of really kind of chaotic emergency department and hospital use to one of more of an ongoing relationship with a primary care team that's based in an outpatient clinic setting and can assist with the coordination of care and really integrating the medical and social services. A few quick numbers related to this population. About 45% of Hennepin Health members have some level of chemical dependency, so nearly half. 42% have a mental or behavioral health diagnosis. And roughly one-third, based on our best proxy measures, have unstable housing. So that gives you a short snapshot of really the challenges faced by this population and what the work of changing the model of care delivery for them entails. And the second sort of unique feature that I'd like to highlight is the financial arrangement. The partners are paid an upfront total cost of care payment that covers all of the enrollees' covered services. And so this really creates different financial incentives for the partners, as you can imagine. And so now building that primary care relationship and ending the cycle of crisis care is now the right thing to do financially as well as the right thing to do clinically. And that's been a powerful driver of change. The bill before you today would exempt the individuals covered by this pilot program from the required cost sharing. And you're going to hear more detail today from Karen Strum, the acting CEO of Metropolitan Health Plan, and Brian Bergs, the CFO, Chief Financial Officer for North Point, who will really give you a more of an on-the-ground picture of what implementing those requirements mean. But I think you'll hear three main themes in our comments today. The first is the high administrative burden really across the system of attempting to collect these amounts. And the second is really the small return on the investment in administrative costs that we have experienced, because our numbers indicate that roughly 80% of our Hennepin Health members are actually exempted from the requirement to have co-pays and cost sharing due to the income caps that are in statute. So, again, a very small return on all of the work that's required. And lastly, and perhaps most importantly, given the work that our partners in Hennepin Health are trying to accomplish to really build relationships and change the way individuals interface with the healthcare and social service systems, the requirement of collecting co-payments and other cost sharing can actually drive a wedge and create barriers between those relationships when we're trying to get folks to adhere to a medication regimen and attend and show up at regularly scheduled office visits. That can actually create a barrier that runs counter to what we're trying to accomplish. And so those are sort of the main themes that we're going to cover today. And with that, I'd like to pass it to Karen Strum, who will give us some additional comments.
Thank you, Ms. Strum.
My name is Karen Strum. I'm the acting CEO for Metropolitan Health Plan. I want to thank you today for taking this opportunity, giving us this opportunity to be here and your consideration of this bill. MHP serves approximately 10,000 Medicare and Medicaid members. 6,000 of those are the Hennepin Health members who have an income of below 75% poverty level, which is about $677 a month. With this, they need to cover all their expenses. Many of the Hennepin Health members, as Ross had indicated, have high mental health needs, many chronic illnesses, and also have numerous visits to the office and numerous medications to be able to control these issues. Because of the low income of this population, paying the copay for an office visit and for medications is not a priority for these individuals for the use of the limited dollars that they have available. This leads to medication noncompliance, resulting in exacerbations of their illnesses and increased emergency room visits as well as hospitalizations. Currently, 90% of the Hennepin Health members have a copay that is very minimal. Of the 90%, 98% of those individuals have no copay at all. It's a zero cap. Administratively, it is very difficult to track the monthly cost sharing. The timeliness of the claim is not aligned with the monthly tracking of the cost sharing cap. For an example, the member sees a provider on January 1st, but the claim does not arrive until March 1st. So on a monthly basis, it's very difficult to accurately calculate what is taking place. Health plans are required to track and submit annual statutory financial filings related to the value of the cost of the cost sharing. The administrative burden of tracking the data, preparing and submitting the report far outweighs the financial benefit of the cost sharing requirement. Health plans are not allowed by contract to bill or hold enrollees responsible in any way for charges related to medically necessary services. Even if billing was possible by the health plan, the bill would probably not be received by the member. MHP's experience is that 50 to 60% of the mailings to the Hennepin Health members are returned because of their frequent relocation. Our request today is to remove the cost-sharing requirement for Hennepin Health members, not only because of the administrative burden to the health plan, but also as a barrier that the cost-sharing creates for the member to maintain their health. We have structured the bill in a way to avoid a fiscal note. This would be budget neutral, and administratively, we are currently absorbing that cost. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Durham. Go ahead and introduce yourself to the committee.
Good afternoon. My name is Brian Bergs. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at North Point Health and Wellness Center. North Point is a federally qualified health center located in North Minneapolis. We have about 80,000 patient visits on an annual basis at our medical, dental, and behavioral health clinics. $3 copay is, as Karen described, a financial burden both administratively and also a financial burden regarding the new model that Hennepin Health is trying to put together. Collecting the $3 copay does take quite a bit of time. About 75% of the patients who actually end up owing it, and Ms. Sturm described that a lot of them don't, and it's difficult to figure out which ones it is that do owe it and don't owe it. But even of those, about 75% do not pay it, in which case then we're required to bill that. As a federally qualified health center, North Point is expected under very strict federal program guidelines to try and collect all patient and insurance fees that are owed to us for our services. So given that burden that we have to at least make a good faith effort to collect it, we do try and collect that $3 fee. Administratively, then, when we do bill it, about 50 to 60% of those bills are returned to us undeliverable. Patients, this population, do not have a stable addresses, and we get a lot of return mail sent back to us. So of those we do bill, we do receive a number back. So as you can see, trying to collect a $3 copay, if you quickly do the math just with postage, gets to be a financial burden. It is also a deterrent to the care model that we are trying to create with Hennepin Health. A lot of the financial incentives that are getting built into what we are doing at Hennepin Health have to do with raising the health status of the patients. And by having an inhibition of the $3 copay, well, it does cause some of the patients to miss their appointments, to not want to show up to their appointments. Trying to create that health model, increase their health status, it is a deterrent to that. And so financially it is not something that we would like to continue doing. We'd like to stop having to pay that. We'd like an exemption. That would allow us under federal law to not have to seek that $3 copay, and would encourage the model that we're trying to set with Hennepin Health. And that ends.
Thank you. I would like to ask a question, but I also have the name of Kathy Lamp on my list. Is she here to be presenting as well? No. Okay, thank you. So that concludes the people who we know of that are interested in testifying on this. So we're going to begin a discussion unless there's somebody else in the audience that intends to speak. Seeing no one. If I were to sort of summarize what I'm hearing, and I would like you to confirm or disconfirm my understanding, Senator Hayden, that there is a request, obviously, to waive the requirement that you collect these copays from a group of people who are likely to not consistently seek services because they can't afford to make this choice over other choices with, did you say $677 a month that they have for all their expenses? So, and in addition, there's the administrative cost to collect the amount of money is greater, probably, than the actual amount of money that you're collecting. Is that correct? So what I'm trying to think about is the policy committee, and Senator Hayden, you might have a good memory. Oftentimes when we're hearing other bills about how to impact health behavior, health action behavior, the use of incentives to encourage people to seek the right care at the right time, and also to discourage people from inappropriate use of the healthcare system, which means delayed care or more expensive care. There's been in the discussion of all of the expansions of Medicaid and this, the concern that we build in incentives that people do use the system correctly. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes, a copay is used as a suggestion for how to make certain that people utilize services wisely, if they have some skin in the game, so to speak. So I think underlying some of this original policy was a discussion around that, as opposed to trying to balance the budget. I don't think this wasn't a budget balancing initiative. I'm just asking about that because what you're saying to us is that if that was the goal, to modify healthcare behavior, it did. But it does it in a way that discourages people getting the right care at the right time in the right place. That's what I'm hearing you say. Senator Hayden.
So, Madam Chair, thank you for that. I think that is really good discussion about this ideal of skin in the game. I think what we'd have to do is put this in its context. So the group of people that we're talking about, those that are 75% of poverty, that have an overwhelming amount of the folks that they are dealing with are chemically dependent, have mental health issues, are homeless, are precariously housed. Those folks were using the emergency room system and other kind of high-cost health care frequently, which was driving up the cost of health care at the federally qualified health care centers, as well, obviously, at Hennepin County Medical Center and other emergency rooms and hospitals around the state. So the ideal of the Hennepin Health model, which is to take a look at who those folks are, do wraparound services, figure out their other needs, help them even with housing and other issues, to allow them to not use the emergency room as a de facto shelter or to wait until they are at a point where they can no longer function to seek medical care. That is what this model is about. And so what they have done is miraculous work in getting people to use the healthcare system appropriately. And I think that's the words that you use, in a way that it helps to manage cost. The outcomes are better. People are starting to think about their lives in a different way. And if they have permanent disabilities, they are working with them to figure that out. But if they are on the road to recovery and are starting to reintegrate with society, that is what the Hennepin Health model has done. What they have found is that the copays are kind of a cost prohibitive. So it is doing the opposite of that. It is now allowing them potentially to not go to make their appointments because they don't have the money in which to pay, which then drives them back into the system that we were helping them to come out of. In addition to that, from an administrative perspective, the cost to send out the bill, the stamp, the paper, the administrative cost, 50 to 60% of those came back because the folks that they're dealing with are precariously housed and we're working with them on that issue. And then the amount of time in which they're taking administratively to try to collect those dollars or figure out, because they can't deny, right, the access, that has essentially been almost as much as it would, and I won't begin to cite specific numbers, but my understanding and listening to them and talking about this, that those administrative costs are rising to the point that it is almost more to try to go out and figure out how to collect it than the actual folks in paying. So in this particular model, which I think is really innovative, and I think that, you know, we talk a lot around here around innovation. Well, this is an innovative model. This is looking at the world slightly different. This is getting the kind of outcomes that we're looking for. This is the health reform that we've been talking about. So the Hennepin Health model is actually getting folks to kind of get better health outcomes with this comprehensive model. And one of the barriers to it has been this copay.
Thank you. Thank you, Senator Hayden. I can tell you that this conversation has occurred in my counties as well. They aren't under the same kind of a system. I had talked with you about maybe including them because they have the same concerns about that the cost to them as a county, as opposed to what the benefit doesn't make financial sense.
Right. And Madam Chair, I will say, and as part of their process and administratively, some of the great folks that are sitting around me, they are incurring the cost. And so I think that is also important, that we're not shifting that cost to the state, that they have developed a model in the ACO context where they are able to incur the copays that they're not collecting, which I think is important. So as we look at other models around the state that are doing that, as they start to develop their comprehensive model, I think if they come or if we were to add them at some later point, I think that's what they would want to – we would want to ensure that they were able to collect – or they were able to absorb those costs that they're not collecting anymore.
Yes, thank you for that, Senator. I was going to mention that I think that to supplement what's already been said, now that you've articulated that, is that there's not a request for this copay that's waived to be funded by the state of Minnesota in a new or fresh way, that it's really integrated in what it is already coming to Hennepin County to serve this population, that you believe so much that it's a drain, unnecessary drain of resources, that you're able to absorb this within the bucket of dollars that you're given to serve this population.
Absolutely.
Okay, great. Further discussion, Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, I think it's obviously a good bill. These co-payments actually make people get worse care, and it costs us more money to give them worse care. So I think it makes sense. The only point I was going to add is that I think the premise that the co-pays are based on, that they have skin in the game, would make good sense if people were begging to go to the doctor all the time. It was so much fun. But most people hate going to the doctor. They may like their doctors, but they don't like going there. And I don't care whether it's chemical dependency or mental health or dental work or whatever. Very few people like to go. And I really think copays are very many times not only not worth the cost of collecting them as it is in this case, but also that it is getting people to make poor choices about not going to see the doctor when they should be going in. So I agree with the chair. We ought to be doing this in more counties, but I strongly disagree with the premise that putting co-payments on things makes people make better choices, because I've seen so many times even a $15 copay for a lot of middle-income people, well, I don't need to go in, and they make foolish choices then. So I'm glad you're at least in this case getting rid of it.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Senator Marty, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Senator Marty. Any further discussion? Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and to our testifiers, thank you for coming forward. I certainly understand collecting a $3 copay can have high administrative costs. In the just over a year that this has been in place, have you seen a decline in emergency room use in this population? And there were some things that we were hoping would happen. I'm just curious to see if you have seen better health outcomes, more stable housing, a decline in the high-cost emergency room visits. Do you? I didn't see any of that information in the packets that were given to us, and I see, you know, some specific cost reductions, but some data on emergency room use and so forth.
Madam Chair.
Please articulate your name for the record again.
Senator Benson, my name is Ross Owen with the Hennepin Health Initiative. We have seen some encouraging directional changes in the rates of both emergency department utilization and inpatient admissions. Partially, the change in behavior around emergency department utilization has been a result of Hennepin County Medical Center expanding its urgent care facility, physically located in the same place where folks enter the emergency department. So the ability to triage people to a more appropriate level of care has been part of that. And we have also seen an encouraging directional reduction in the rate of overall admission, suggesting that folks are accessing care at more appropriate venues. So it's very early in the initiative, and because we've seen a fair amount of turnover in our enrolled population, it's been a little bit difficult to interpret, and we've been cautious in interpreting some of the trends, but they're generally headed in the directions we'd like to see.
And
Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, and Mr. Owens or whomever could address this, you talk about the $3 being prohibitive. How many people do you say would you estimate come to the doctor's office, and when they say, well, it'll be $3, they turn around and walk away?
Again, for the record, my name is Brian Bergs, the Chief Financial Officer at North Point Health and Wellness Center. Anecdotally, I don't think I've heard of anyone turning around and walking away, but we do have a high failure rate for this population, and it's hard to say exactly how much would be due to the $3 copay, but there certainly are some. None that have come forward and said, well, I'm not coming in. I'm not going to pay that $3 copay, and I'm not going to go today. More of them have the opinion that they don't have it with them. They will still be seen by the doctor. As Senator Marty pointed out, people don't really like going to the doctor, and so if they're showing up at the clinic, they're likely going to be seen there. The appointments that they're more likely not to show up for, and this I don't have any data for it, but it would be, hypothetically, it would be those wellness visits that we are trying to put in place as a way to reduce to increase the overall health status of the patients. It's the new model that we're looking at. What I can say is there is a very high rate of no-shows for this population.
Senator Benson.
And Madam Chair, the statute, actually I'm looking at page 1, line 11, the copay applies to non-preventive visits, so wellness would be included in a preventive visit. And so I'm not going to oppose this bill because I think the administrative burden is a reasonable argument, but we already exempt wellness visits. If we're having success moving people from the operating room, let's keep this focused on the burden that it's placing on you, and not that people are leaving because of a $3 charge. I'm going to need a little bit more numerical support, some census information, before I'm going to believe that people are not showing up for health care because of $3 when wellness is exempted. Non-emergencies are very low. Generic drugs are low, and we exempt anything for mental illness. There are a lot of broad exemptions in this bill already, and if it's an undue burden on you to collect it, I appreciate giving you some relief, but I want to stay focused on why we're doing this.
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I appreciate that, and I always appreciate you keeping us on task, but I do think that part of what we're trying to do with the with this particular project is not always rooted directly in the numbers, and you can't always tease that out. But what I will say is, as we and I would encourage the committee, as we go into the interim and start to look at these things, is to kind of visit and talk to the people in that population and have that conversation. That can't always be captured, unfortunately, numerically, but as you and if you've worked with this population, you know that these kind of things are prohibitive, and sometimes we just have not either worked with them or been in their shoes, but often I think the folks that are around the table here and others that work directly with this population would differ. We can't always want quantify that, if you will, but I do think that often these kinds of administrative or these kind of issues do prevent people from making that next step to go get the care that they so desperately need.
Thank you. Mr. Bergs, it looked like you wanted to speak to the issue Senator Benson raised about, I think the question was whether or not the issue of deferring care or not to following up on medications was a basis for supporting this bill. Did you want to speak to that specifically?
Yes, thank you. Just a very short statement on that. The legislature, in its wisdom, did carve those out, and that I think that was a very wise move. But as Senator Hayden was saying, this population sometimes they have a harder time differentiating between what's going to be a wellness visit and what isn't. So to them, to many of them, they will just say, oh, you know, they charged me $3 last time I was there, and it will be in their mind that this is just another visit, whereas it takes they might not understand that those visits would not be charged.
Senator Nelson and then Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden, I think from the discussion I understand the goal of this bill to remove potential barriers to people receiving health care and reduce administrative costs. I'm a little bit fuzzy on the fiscal implications of this bill, and so I wanted to know, one, if there's a fiscal note, and then two, I think probably the answer is no, but I'd like you to explain the last sentence in the bill, what that means exactly, that the value of the copayments shall not be included in this capitation. So how does that affect who's paying who's making up the difference of those copays that will no longer be collected, and how does that relate to the capitation amount received at the hospital?
Madam Chair,
Senator Hayden,
Senator Nelson, thank you for that. My understanding is that there is no fiscal impact to the state, but I will allow Ms. Strum to answer some of the more technical parts of your question.
Ms. Durham.
Thank you, Senator Nelson. We are currently absorbing the cost, the administrative cost. We are not asking for any, it would be budget neutral, so we are not asking for any changes in terms of the payment for these individuals.
Senator Nelson.
Just to follow up, so translate this last statement for me, though. What does that mean, that the copayment will not be included in the capitation amount? So if the capitation amount is $100, I'm just making up a number, and now there's not a $3 copayment, how do those numbers work together?
That there would not be a reduction or an addition to the capitation, to the payment.
Okay, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So the capitation rate remains the same whether or not there is a copay?
That's correct, Senator Nelson.
All right, thank you.
Senator Nino.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It seems to me that the more compelling argument for this bill really is from the standpoint of these testifiers up here talking about administrative costs, and that they're probably spending as much to get whatever they have coming in as a result, and I get that. philosophically and as a matter of policy, I get concerned when we're completely disengaging healthcare consumers from the cost of healthcare. And I don't make that statement completely in ignorance and completely from an ivory tower of sitting here at the table at the Senate Health and Human Services Committee. I've lived through poverty. I've been there as a husband and a father with children, and I never once said, boy, we shouldn't go in because I have a $20 copay. I did, however, on a Sunday night, ask the question, can we wait till Monday or should we go into ER and pay the $100 copay? And there were times when we waited till Monday, and there were times when we went in and paid the $100 copay. So I get a little, and I have friends who had the state plan before there were copays, who would go into the ER for headaches. And close friends, people I've known for years, and I would shake my head and say, "Do you have any idea what that costs?" But they didn't have a copay, so what do they care? And so I get a little concerned when we completely disengage consumers. And I, quite honestly, probably never made it down to the 75% of poverty level. But I had significantly more than a $3 copay, too. So there's really not a question in there, Senator Hayden, more of just a comment that I get concerned when we get the consumers one more step away from reality.
So thank you, Madam Chair, Senator
Hayden.
Nienau, I appreciate that, and I don't know if we'll come to an agreement philosophically on this ideal of skin in the game. I think I'm a little closer to Senator Marty's position on this, but I can appreciate the ideal of skin in the game and people being responsible. I think, and that's where, I guess I should apologize. I wasn't trying to be flip with Senator Benson about working and talking to people. I happened to come before I was in the legislature working with the clientele that this particular initiative has served. And so in listening and talking to them and walking through their shoes or walking with them in their shoes, you sometimes gain a different perspective than just the perspective that we sometimes come from about us or our friends or where we were on the kind of socioeconomic scale. You know, the folks that we are working with here are really poor and have been poor a long time and that are dealing with a lot of issues that they are trying to climb themselves out of. And so in thinking about it, it may not look to us from the position that we sit, wherever that was or how our life has kind of worked for us, that this would be a big deal. But sometimes it is. And sometimes just another burden of having to go to the doctor and deal with how am I going to make this copayment, how am I going to afford kind of this, even though I know that I have an issue, the dignity factor of how even in our public assistance programs, which we should, they're highly accountable. We fill out a lot of forms and we ask a lot of questions, and I'm not saying that we shouldn't, but that takes a toll on people. And I think that the model that these guys have or that our testifiers have developed is responsible. It works well not only administratively, but it also starts to have and develops a relationship with people that are starting to, I think, get the outcomes that we're looking for. So, you know, once again, I don't think I'm going to convince you otherwise, but I would just say that as we start to think about this, there is a different paradigm or there is a different lens that sometimes people who are in this position look at these issues with.
Okay. Thank you. All right. If there's no further discussion, Senator Hayden, the question is on your motion to move Senate File 147, that it be recommended to pass, and then referred to Finance.
Yes.
If it doesn't have a fiscal note, does it need to go to Finance? I guess Finance would like to review it. So there's a request to have it go to Finance.
But Madam Chair, that's fine with me.
Okay, great. Thank you. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
Senator Wicklund.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Good afternoon, Senator Sharon.
Thank you.
Would you like to present
Madam
your bill,
Chair.
Senate file number 159.
Thank you very much. Thank you, members of the committee. I am going to present for your overview what Senate file 159 has in store. And I have also the opportunity to introduce you to Barb Christensen from Nicollet County and Devin Nelson from Cottonwood County Habilitative Services, who are the persons who are seeking your support for this legislation. I'm also very happy to say that Senator Weber is a co-author on this bill with me, and he is the senator representing Cottonwood County. Senate File 159 is a bill that transfers one ICF bed from the Home of Creative Living in Windham, Cottonwood County, to the Children's ICFDD facility in Nicollet County. The bill also changes the certification of the facility in Windham from 21 beds to 20 beds. Now, the corporate foster care moratorium was made effective in July of 2009. And among a variety of reasons, the main goal behind the moratorium was to aid the long-term goal of keeping more people living in their own homes or in less restrictive settings, whenever that would be possible. The moratorium does not allow any new corporate foster care beds to be built or moved. Unless their use falls under one of the exceptions that are articulated. So what Senate File 159 does is creates another exception for the transfer of an intermediate care facility developmental disability bed from Cottonwood County to Nicollet County. Nicollet County has been working the last year and a half to develop a 5-bed ICFDD facility for children. In preparation, the county has closed 4 beds from an adult ICFDD site and obtained approval from DHS for one additional bed. However, because of the moratorium, Nicollet County cannot simply add another bed. Instead, they had to find another funded empty bed that another county is not currently using and would be willing to transfer to Nicollet County. And that's where Windham comes into play. Home of Creative Living in Windham had decided to downsize their facility from 21 to 18 beds. But the facility wishes to use the savings from the decreased beds, to raise their current rates. Oh, man. That'll come back to haunt me somewhere. So anyway, Windham is willing to transfer one of their beds to Nicollet County while keeping the payments for the other two on their rolls. Therefore, Windham would be decertified from 21 beds to a 20-bed facility and would save the rates from the empty 2 beds and transfer the third to Nicollet County. In the end, Nicollet County will have a 5-bed facility and Windham will have a 20-bed facility, but with only 18 full beds. So that is an overview of the bill. And this is the policy committee. The fiscal issues, I'll just be upfront with you, we are in conversation. There's not a fiscal note at this time for this committee on this issue. We'll be meeting with the department after this committee hearing to discuss further what will be considered a fiscal implication for this bill, if any. And so I'm not able to really fully answer any questions that you may have at this time about that. So I'm hoping that questions that come forward are related to the testifier's ability to talk about what they're trying to accomplish. And with that, I would invite Devin, I think I'll begin with you and have you describe where you're at and then turn it over to Ms. Christensen. Devin Nelson.
Thank you. Thank you, and please state your name and title for the record.
Okay, thank you. My name is Devin Nelson. I'm the administrator of the Home for Creative Living in Windham, Minnesota. And thank you for the opportunity to speak. As Senator Sharon described, the process probably isn't as complicated as it is until you try to talk about it, and then it gets to be rather confusing. The Home for Creative Living originally opened in September of 1977 as a 45-bed facility for adults with intellectual and physical disabilities. And in 1994, the home was downsized to a 21-bed facility and relicensed to serve both children and adults. And what we realized in that process was a lot of the children that originally were living there grew older and there was no place for them to go, and we relicensed to serve both children and adults. The Home for Creative Living serves as a regional resource. We currently serve individuals from 13 different counties. Although we're located in Wacoma County facility, it is a service that is in much in demand in that region. Cottonwood County, we've talked with them about our request to decertify 3 beds and downsize to 18. They support our request. Downsizing to 18 beds, some of the pluses we see is, one, it would allow each of the people living there to have a single bedroom. Right now with 21 people, we do have 3 people that are in a shared bedroom situation, and we would like to move beyond that if possible. And reducing the occupancy of the home would allow us to, I think, remain more financially viable over the years to come. Being full at 21, you know, our occupancy varies from 18, 19, 20, 21. Downsizing to 18 should allow us to stay more financially viable. Briefly put, our proposal is to decertify 3 beds and transfer 1 bed to Nicollet County to support their development. And the funding tied to our rate, the bed that would be decertified and moved to Nicollet County would be at or less than the current rate for HCL. And then the overall picture, as far as Senator Sharon mentioned, that we would want to use some of the funding, the forecasted funding attached to the 2 beds that would be decertified to cover some of the fixed costs, which do not change when we go from 21 to 18 beds. So that's briefly what our proposal is.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. And would you like to please state your name for the record?
Barb Christensen from Nicollet County. I'm a social services supervisor, and one of the units I supervise is the developmental disabilities unit. We're very excited and been working really hard at trying to have this opportunity to work with Cottonwood County and the Region 9 in our area to try to give options to families to keep their children closer to home. We serve a variety of children, from minor services like respite to try to keep them in their family home. And then if things don't work out, we bring in personal care attendant services and try to offer those as support. Sometimes situations continue to be complicated, and due to the nature of the children's disorders or disabilities or the family situation, the situations turn into crises, and then we don't have anything real close in our area to be able to support the children to stay close to their family home. When we proposed this bill, we had 2 to 3 children that we were serving. One went to Red Wing, an awesome service there, and also in La Crosse, Wisconsin was the only other place we could find. Now, these places are awesome places, and they serve our children well, but they're too far away from our families. Our families cannot be involved in their children's school activities, their medical stuff really very well. Those kinds of support services, when you have a 2 to 3 hour drive one way. We also have responsibilities to case manage from that distance, and that makes it difficult. But most importantly is getting the services that support the children to be able successful and to be in the least restrictive sites as possible. We do have some mandates that we need to follow with that. And so we are looking for, and are very excited that we want to use existing resources, we want to use existing providers in this region of the state so our children don't have to go so far when all of the familiar services do not work out well in the family homes. At least the family can still be involved in the child's life, and we can get them services to keep them for more critical services and hopefully get some stabilization. And in some cases, the children can return home because we're able to provide the intensity and level of services that the children need. The families can't provide. Families struggle enough to get everyday life things done, let alone being up 24/7, attending medical appointments, psychiatric appointments, neurological appointments, maybe dietary appointments, any kind of therapies plus education meetings and all of that. The demand on the families is pretty intense. So our support is really reaching out and trying to use the resources that we have. And currently we have 11 to 12 people that are interested in our Home of Five now. Some are interested as far as Winona. I mean, people sort of looking across the state, and I think people are really searching to find the right services to support these children and to help them be successful and functional to the best of their abilities. So we're really excited. We think we can do this, and all we need is one bed. So we're really excited to make a go of this. So we hope you will support that.
Thank you. Senator Sharon, did you have any other comments?
No, I think that unless there are clarifying questions, I will acknowledge again that the issue of the rate adjustment, which is a part of this proposal, is a fiscal issue that will be reviewed in the Finance Committee. But what we're seeking also is this additional exception for Nicollet County facility for the one bed to be transferred from Cottonwood County to Nicollet County.
Thank you. Do committee members, Senator Nelson.
Thank you, excuse me. Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Sharon, I understand and really applaud the creativity in actually making those bed transfers to where the need is. But I have a question about the policy side. I know you don't have the fiscal note yet, but I am trying to understand why would we want to continue to pay for two empty beds that we would not be paying for without this bill. Is that correct? And so why should the taxpayers pay for two empty beds? Would it not be better to put that money into serving a patient?
Senator Sharon.
Yes, Devin Nelson, Home of Creative Living. The reason that we're looking at a rate adjustment is in 1994, when we did our downsizing from 45 beds to 21, the state policy was to allow a funded downsizing, which means you could make adjustments to your rates to cover some of the costs that don't really go down based on occupancy. And with the moratorium, the ability to do a funded downsizing was no longer allowed. And so what we're looking at is, as I mentioned, we would decertify three beds, and we're not interested in just simply taking the funding for 20 and dividing by 18, because that's not what we need. But if we were going to become an 18-bed facility, which we think has real positive implications for the people living at HCL and also to keep the home viable as a resource for that region, we would want to make an adjustment to cover the fixed costs. And so you're correct in what you're stating, that it would be spending it would be less money, theoretically, than the 20 beds would be, but it would be more than 18 at the current rate. So we're trying to find something and I think from the policy perspective, we're looking at it as a positive for the people that live there and that would move there in the future, and also to keep it viable for that region. Nobody knows how long in the future ICFDD will be a model that's in favor, but the people we support are the people that have the most significant medical, physical, and intellectual disabilities. So that's the reason for the request. And you're correct. We couldn't make this request unless there was a compelling reason and a need for that bed somewhere else. But I guess from our perspective, if we want to stay viable, we thought we would, that it made sense for those reasons. Thank you.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to follow up,
Was there a follow-up question?
Yes, there is.
May I just add before you go
please.
On? I think also the another part of the discussion in response to Senator Nelson is to understand that the fixed costs that we're talking about at Cottonwood County remain. And so they will trying to figure out a way to help release beds that could better be used in other places that they won't release if they can't accomplish what they need to in terms of sustaining the financial stability of the facility that exists there now. So I just wanted to raise that to your consciousness, that part of achieving the goal of what is needed in Nicollet County rests on the ability of Cottonwood County to continue to maintain the the services and the facility that they have.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you. So my follow-up then kind of goes along two lines. One, and my iPad is out of battery, I'd look it up. What are those exceptions that are already in law that would apply if the conditions were met, but they don't, so we have this bill in front of us, and I'm sure somebody will get that for me from there. And then my second question has to do with precedent setting then. So is there concern that this would be setting a precedent for other non-used beds to continue to be funded?
Senator Sharon, did you?
Thank you, Senator Wicklund. I'm looking to Senate staff to be able to answer some of those questions, and they're looking.
Thank you.
In law.
Senator Benson, do you want to ask your question?
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this can be directed to whomever can answer it. If the rate adjustment for Cottonwood County doesn't go through, does that mean it's a deal breaker? If we transfer a bed without continuing the funding for the two empty beds, is that a deal breaker?
Mr. Nelson?
Yes. Thank you, Madam Chair. Devin Nelson. For us, we would need to have a rate adjustment if we're going to transfer a bed. So, yes, it would be.
Okay. I'd also Senator ask Sharon. Ms. Christensen to talk about the struggle to find in Nicollet County a solution to their problem over a period of time and how this offer from Cottonwood County relates to that.
Ms. Christensen, Nicollet County. I searched probably for 6 to 8 months connecting with every county in the state, asking them for any unused beds. Is there any way that they are not going to use a bed, not something not work out, that they would be willing to transfer a bed to us? Because that is allowable now. That is allowable for counties to be able to work together. But I believe the survival rate of every county and sites are going to hang on to whatever they've got just because of the fear with the moratorium, with the needs of the clients and the difficulties it is to serve folks. I had no responses, no willingness from none of the other 84 counties to willing to try to work with us on that, even though they would benefit from them. Some of them would have loved to, but they were not able to feel that they could fiscally do that within their services for their current adults or children and their sites. So pretty much everybody's hanging on, so it got to be kind of pretty much going to sabotage our whole effort at making this go until Cottonwood County was able to really relook at things that they could provide. And if they were able to get a little bit, then they could give a little bit to us. Then we'd be both winners in our areas if we could serve both children and adults. No other provider was able or willing to put the time and effort into that. So I appreciate that.
Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Sharon, you have more experience at this than I do. Could the Commissioner of Health simply certify one additional bed?
There is a moratorium on the beds, and so in order to do that, you'd have to get an exception to the moratorium. And there has been a desire, strong desire, a resistance to changing that because the preference would be what is happening here, which is the reorganization of the beds to locations where they are needed rather than expanding the higher cost service.
And thank you, Madam Chair. It just seems we're jumping through a lot of hoops to accomplish something that sounds fairly straightforward and necessary. And so the ramification of this very strong cap is that we're creating more hoops and doing more jumping. And I'm sure it's incredibly frustrating to the people operating these facilities and trying to do the right thing. And so it's part of a broader discussion. When we limit flexibility to contain costs, we also limit creativity. And it's just a comment, no question. Thank you.
Dave, did you have information?
Yes, Madam Chair and members of the committee. The exception to the moratorium is essentially, I mean, to sum it up quick, it's at the discretion of the Commissioner of Human Services if it's determined that there is a need, if the facility is being developed in accordance with the request for proposal approved by the Commissioner of Human Services. And so there seems to be a fair amount of leeway in terms of the department granting exceptions to the moratorium if the need is determined.
Senator Sharon, did you have comment on that? Okay. Are there any further questions? Senator Nelson.
So just one more then in light of that. So have you asked the commissioner about making the exception that she can do statutorily without legislative approval?
Senator Sharon.
Thank you. Barb Christensen would like to respond to that.
Ms. Christensen.
Hi, Barb Christensen from Nicollet County. We did actually request two beds from DHS, battled for about 4 weeks, and were able to settle on one, only if I could get that from somewhere else. And so with the list of exemptions that we understood, it had to be due to a closure of an ICF MR site. And so it was our understanding with both the Department of Human Services and the Department of Health that we had, that our only option was to be able to get a transfer from another county, that we did not, was not our knowledge that brought to us that it was a commissioner discretion to be able to have that bed. That was not shared with us.
Thank you. Are there any further questions? If there's no further discussion,
I certainly would make a motion, if I haven't already, to pass Senate File 159 and refer it to Finance.
All those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Any opposed? Motion passes.
Hello, Senator Hayden.
Good morning, Madam Chair. It feels
good
like,
afternoon.
We've done this before.
You're here before us with Senate File 111.
Absolutely.
All
Thank
right.
you. Madam Chair, I'd like to move Senate File 111 to pass and be referred to Finance, I think.
I think the bill says it gets referred to Finance.
Or to healthcare Finance.
I guess there's an advisory committee. Senator Hayden probably has to go to state and local
state
government.
Local, you're right.
First?
Yep.
You're probably trying to avoid that.
Well, I'm on the committee, so hopefully I can usher that through.
Please. Thank you, Senator Hayden. Would you please review the bill for the committee members?
Good. Thank you, Madam Chair, members. I'd like to say, for the record, this is a good bill. I know that we all think that everyone is, but this is a very good bill. We have named this bill the Jablonski-Rodrick Spinal Cord Injury and Traumatic Brain Injury Program. The bill is the kind of bill that I really like, not only for the work that it is doing, but it was originated by one of my constituents who are going to speak to you today, Matthew and Gabe Rodrick. They approached me well over a year ago, really just talking about the issue of spinal cord injury. And as you'll see, our testifier, Gabe Rodrick, had a spinal cord injury on a exchange program in the Caribbean where he was diving and landed the wrong way. And the bill, the concept originally was the work that Gabe was doing, the rehabilitative work and the curative therapy work he was doing with his father, and they were building a gym to help with his therapy, along with the great work that they were doing at the Courage Center and other places to continue to push Gabe along as he recovered from his injury. We started to talk about this in the context of how do we bring enlightenment and maybe resources to it, and that manifested into this bill, which is essentially, Madam Chair, members asking for $4 million for spinal cord research. When Gabe was injured, Gabe was injured 4 years ago, and once again, he's here. The bill's pretty simple. It asks for $8 million over the next biennium. We will create a board in the next biennium via the Department of Health, the Commissioner of Health. The members are outlined in Section 3 of the bill, and that this advisory group would then take the appropriation and create, along with the Department of Health, the Commissioner of Health, would review it and create criteria for organizations in our community who specialize in this therapy to receive these funds to hopefully, if not find a cure for spinal cord research, most certainly find therapies and to do some of the great work that has shown promising to start to get more movement in those that have been affected by this issue. One of the things that we looked at last year was we do have a small appropriation that comes from reckless driving and driving while impaired. Some of that fee goes to the traumatic brain injury for direct services, but and then a little bit goes to spinal cord research registry, where those who have had this injury can go to find services. In developing this bill, we thought that the amount that we were spending was low. There are a number of other states, and it's in your packet, that have started to fund the research for spinal cord injuries, as well as new therapies, as I might say, for traumatic brain injuries. I think many of us have seen in the news lately, in particular, the spine of the traumatic brain injuries, sports and other of folks that are getting this and a lot of the damage that has been done. And so there is great work that is moving forward. My testifiers will talk a lot about some of the specifics of that. And once again, we can't, you know, it is a little difficult to track down the exact cost, but we think it's in upwards of $2 billion a year that we spend on this, and we are hoping that the appropriation that we will give today, though we will not talk directly about the financing side, that will ultimately, if this bill moves forward, end up in our finance division. But we think the policy is good. We think that it is good for the state of Minnesota to be a partner along with our research universities and hospitals, as well as the philanthropic community, to really start to engage in this process. I think you'll find some compelling testimony from not only our testifiers, but also some of our doctors and experts in the field. You know, I do want to make a point, because I know that this has been a little bit of a bone of contention as I have talked about this bill. You know, we are not looking to rob Peter to pay Paul for this bill. We are not looking to take money that is already set aside in the community for folks that are living with spinal cord or neurological issues. We are hoping that there are new dollars that we can find that can help to fund this. This bill and the appropriation is a starting point. You know, we would think that this would be fantastic. It would hire about 75 to 80 researchers to work on this. We think that that would accelerate the path, but we will be open based on, you know, our state's fiscal situation, and as we start to talk about those numbers, to amending that. But as we started to move forward, we wanted to put some sort of dollar amount in placeholder in the bill. So I do think that this is a good bill. I do think that it provides not just hope, but there is really hard science that starts to speak to this issue of finding a way for us to have increased mobility, increased bodily functions, and then maybe one day people will be able to have greater mobility in their life. If that means that they will walk again or not, I don't want to kind of exploit that. There are a lot of things that people can do that they're not doing today that we're hoping that they could do with this great research. So with that, Madam Chair, I think that that is essentially the bill, and we also have testifiers that have come forward to testify in support of the bill, and I think there are some folks here that have some concerns about what we're doing.
Thank you. Is there anything that anybody would like to ask about the bill before we listen to the testifiers? We'll have time for more questions later. Okay, great. Thank you. The first person whose name is on my bill is Matthew Roderick. That's followed. This is a constituent of Senator Hayden's.
Good.
And that would be followed by Deborah Brown. And Gabe Roderick. Would Gabe also like to come forward at this time? So Gabe and Matthew Roderick. Welcome to the committee. Please say your name for the record before you speak.
My name is Gabriel Roderick. I am a C5 quadriplegic. I was injured in a diving accident 4.5 years ago. And I'm here speaking today on behalf of all spinal cord injuries. I was broken on that day. My body was broken. Every day since, I've been wanting to be fixed. There are a lot of other complications that come along with this. It's not just a broken neck. It's a broken body. It's a broken digestive system. It's a broken diaphragm. It's many broken things. And I've been hospitalized 2 times in the last 2 years, I think, for pneumonia. I've had a lot of other complications. And I want to be cured. I don't want to be cared for anymore. I want to be cured. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Roderick.
And Madam Chair, if I may add, I didn't address the bill, Jablonski and Roderick, which is Matthew's here, Gabe is here. Jack Jablonski, which we, I think, have all seen in the news, him and his family were unable to be here. But I do want to make just kind of a statement, because I know sometimes when we name bills, we're figuring out the relationship between the Jablonski and the Roderick family was developed through them. And it was their family that contacted them and decided to lend their name. And I think that that's important, because it speaks to not only why are we here and why is it named after them, but also the kind of sense of community that develops with this population.
Thank you. This is Matthew Roderick.
It is, Madam Chair. My name is Matthew Roderick. I am Gabe's dad. And to echo what Senator Hayden said, Gabe and Jack have worked many days together at the Courage Center and the ABLE program, which is activity-based locomotor exercise, a very aggressive regimen, both to keep healthy and fit, but also looking for some regenerative changes. It's a therapy modality that is relatively new, but somewhat successful. But that's the connection that the Jablonskis and we have. Unfortunately, they have a number of things going on of late, which have kept them from appearing in a lot of things. Many of you have a letter that I delivered to your offices on Friday. So I won't reiterate or repeat that and waste time. And I did have the opportunity to have a little FaceTime with Senator Eaton. Thank you. So please refer to that if you haven't. It gives a little bit of a background on the injury of my son, when, and its effects, and then a couple of points that I tried to make about why I believe this bill is worthy of your consideration and worthy of a yes vote. But again, I won't reiterate, but I wanted to say just a couple of things that I didn't say in the letter. And some of it first comes from a bit of ruminating yesterday as I was gathering my thoughts to speak to all of you. And I started really simply with one thing. I just kept thinking about the name of this committee, the Health Policy Committee. And as I ruminated about that, it's really what I began to think about is recognizing the enormous responsibility that you all have to make decisions that have such a profound effect on our communities, on families like mine, and others that you'll hear from today. And I wanted to just let you know that I think I understand that to the degree that I'm able, recognizing that the responsibility that you have and appreciate it, especially in the face of limited resources and various times in various years where that those limited resources are either greater or lesser. But really, it's a question, my ruminating, which was, is an investment in cure good healthcare policy? And I think what you might see in some of the conversation, and for instance, for those who would resist this effort, there is a tension that exists in my community, a community that I've become more and more of an advocate for, and that tension is care versus cure, particularly in the spinal cord injury community. There's a organization in the state, the Spinal Cord Society, which their logo is cure, not care, with an X through a wheelchair. Very somewhat aggressive image in the face of another side of that community, which is focused on care, which is to change the perception that the able-bodied community has of the disabled community, as if it were lesser valued or different on the inside, despite the state of the body. That tension is one I think we feel, even as a family. Obviously, there are, as in my letter, I won't reiterate too much, there are substantial financial implications for a spinal cord injury. First year of my son's injury, between hospitalizations and therapy and modifications, approached just under $1 million within, I think, about 9 months. I know that we're well over $1 million now in 4.5 years. The projected cost of an injury incurred at 25 over a lifetime is well over, I think it's somewhere around $2.7 million for a higher level injury like Gabe's, as he stated, is a C5. It's a costly injury, and that's financial, but it's also costly socially, psychologically, emotionally. I probably don't need to convince you of that. What I am here to convince you is that what is often overlooked and what has changed even since my son's injury is the potential and possibility for a curative therapy. The science has moved significantly in the 4.5 years since my son's injury. We actually traveled to India twice to receive embryonic stem cell treatments because there's really nothing available in the States that would even approach that. Gabe got some modest benefit from that, not significant. I believe it was safe. Did my due diligence to make sure of that. But we traveled overseas, and those two trips spent well over $100,000 in pursuit of those treatments, and treatments that, again, did have benefit. But in all honesty, I think there are places around the world that are sort of throwing a treatment against the wall, hoping something will stick. What we have now is a really significant change, and that comes in the form of some of the labs that are in this state. For instance, Dr. Parr's work using what are called iPS cells, induced pluripotent stem cells. These are non-embryonic stem cells that are derived from, for instance, your skin. Take your skin cells, reprogram them genetically into becoming stem cells that can grow into neurons or nerve cells, which would then be transplanted into someone like Gabe to regrow an area that's been damaged or contused. Really significant, but this is only this was discovered a year before my son's injury. This is very new and has kind of blasted onto the scene in research, and now we have a lab in the state of Minnesota that's actually doing that and is making gains and is actually even this year partnering with an independent lab from the Spinal Cord Society to do that research and loan her cells for an FDA trial. Significant gains and significant changes that are real. And I guess really fundamentally what I'd say is that in this state we have three of what I think are the five components to cure spinal cord injury. Three are actively being researched now. Cells, I mentioned a rehab modality which exists at the Courage Center and the VA and the Mayo and other places. Those are two. The third is an architecture for the spinal cord injured area, a matrix, which is being developed at the Mayo Clinic through Dr. Windebank. Four and five do not exist directly here, but they are close by, both in Ohio and Illinois and Wisconsin, and these are labs that I've tried to connect some of the labs here too. Five components that are necessary, I think many people believe are necessary to provide a significant curative therapy for spinal cord injury, are here in the state of Minnesota. Unfortunately, in my opinion, they are woefully underfunded because spinal cord injury is a small population. A small population that is not forgotten on the care side of things, but I think especially as the science is accelerating, is forgotten on the cure side. So in my opinion, cure is a good healthcare policy. An investment in cure is a good healthcare policy, fundamentally, but also financially over the long term. Significant gains can be made and significant reduction of cost over the lifetime of my son and our family. Thank you. I hope I didn't ramble on too much, but I appreciate your time.
Thank you, Mr. Roderick. Thank you also, Gabe, for presenting today. We also have requests from Deborah Brown and Dr. Galen Roxwold to testify. Would they please come forward?
Would you like Roxwald, I think. The Madam
right.
Chair, he thought he
Dr. Roxwald.
Work well with her.
Would you begin? Please say your name and your position, please.
My name is Dr. Galen Roxwald. I was chief of neurosurgery at the Hennepin County Medical Center for 35 years and professor of neurosurgery at the University of Minnesota and medical director of the Traumatic Brain Injury Center at HCMC. I have taken care of TBI and spinal cord injury patients throughout my career. I appreciate the opportunity to solicit support for this important bill supporting spinal cord injury and TBI research. The personal loss and tragedy of a person suffering a spinal cord injury is immediately obvious. One can only imagine coming to the intensive care unit and being told your loved one is quadriplegic. It is not only the loss of muscle movement, but the loss of vital functions like bowel, bladder, and sexual function. Traumatic brain injury represents a wider spectrum of injury. TBI is classified as mild, moderate, or severe. Severe TBI patients, although representing 10% of all TBI, are those that die. A third of them die, and about 40% make a reasonable recovery. Brain injury is the leading cause of disability and death in children. 80% of TBI patients suffer what's called a mild TBI, or a concussion. And about 20% of these patients go on to develop a disabling post-concussive syndrome, including intellectual and memory disturbance. And Deborah Brown will give her own experience for that. Because these complications are not readily apparent, TBI has been termed the silent epidemic. Given our basic human empathy and compassion, I don't think we need convincing regarding the significance of these injuries to our central nervous system. The real question, it seems to me, before us this afternoon is, why should the Minnesota legislature designate scarce, hard-earned Minnesota tax dollars on a spinal cord injury and TBI research fund? First, it is important to understand the economic impact these injuries have in the state of Minnesota. And I realize this is going to the fiscal committee or whatever, but I think we need to get just a taste of this. There are about 14,000 individuals sustaining a TBI in Minnesota annually. Over 100,000 Minnesotans live with a disability as a result of TBI. The lifetime direct medical cost, as well as the estimated cost of lost wages, is $85,000 for mild TBI, $941,000 for moderate TBI, and $3 million for a severe TBI. There are, on average, about 300 spinal cord injured patients in Minnesota annually. The estimated lifetime cost for a 25-year-old quadriplegic is about $3 million. For a paraplegic, $2 million. So just doing the math, I agree. There's at least $2 billion cost in direct medical costs, and probably even more of that if you figure in all the economic productivity that's lost due to these two injuries. The second main issue relates to funding and research. I've been the principal investigator on NIH-funded clinical research in TBI over the past two decades. There has been a major reduction in the amount of funding available over that time period. For example, the NIH success rate for research proposals in 2002 was 31%. In 2012, it was 17.6%, or a relative reduction of 45%. The percentage of the NIH budget, total budget, the percentage for spinal cord injury and TBI runs less than a percent, despite the enormous socioeconomic consequences of these injuries. So how would a state-sponsored research fund help this situation? Prior to funding a randomized clinical trial, which is the gold standard in changing clinical practice, the NIH, the Department of Defense, and industry have become appropriately demanding for compelling preliminary data. That is scientific evidence that the mechanisms involved in a potential treatment for evidence for clinical efficacy. That is the treatment going to work in benefiting the patient? At present, it's very difficult for young investigators to get funding for these necessary preliminary and basic clinical investigations to move the field forward. So daunting a challenge that fewer and fewer young investigators are entering the field and others are abandoning the effort. A state-supported research fund would provide startup funds for young and even more mature investigators to initiate these potentially very important preliminary studies. My vision for this research fund would be to cast a wide net for proposals that would fund innovative projects that would include specific treatments for spinal cord injury and TBI, as well as injury prevention and rehabilitation. We have a robust medical technology and scientific community in Minnesota, which has been a leader, particularly in the treatment of heart disease, which is on the decline. I think Minnesota can also be a leader in the area of spinal cord injury and TBI research, which has been so long neglected. For a relatively small investment, this initiative could have a major impact on the health of our citizens, as well as on the large socioeconomic burden created by these injuries. Thank you for your attention.
Thank you, Doctor. Ms. Deborah Brown.
Hi, this is Deborah Brown. I'm a patient at HCMC, and I want to thank you for an opportunity to speak for and support this bill and share a little bit about my personal journey through this. In November of 2011, I was in a car accident and suffered a traumatic brain injury. I did not realize that I injured my head in any way. I got up the next morning and I went to work, and I could feel that I was physically declining, but really just thought I was tired. And it wasn't until the next day a friend of mine found that I was not speaking well. And that was a trigger for her that I needed to seek medical attention. My initial meeting with a doctor, after I went to the ER, I went to a follow-up exam, and even though it would have only been like a week since the accident, the doctor originally diagnosed me as depressed because I'd had an accident and wanted to put me on antidepressant medication for being depressed for a week. My friends helped to support me and get me engaged with HCMC, which has a program for TBI, and that's how I started my true recovery. This traumatic brain injury has had a significant impact on my life. So just, I wrote down a few key things I wanted to share. I could not care for myself or my family. I couldn't complete daily chores. I could not go grocery shopping. I could not drive. I could not communicate with my family or friends in a meaningful way. I was unable to work in any capacity for several weeks, and my visual impairment prevented me from being able to read, watch TV, or do anything on the computer. I could not communicate meaningfully with anybody in my family, any of my friends. I could not communicate with anybody on the outside world. And initially, I was diagnosed as just being depressed. Because I was unable to go grocery shopping, shop, or make meals for myself, I did get some assistance from my family and my friends. Once they found out what was happening, I had a wonderful support network that helped. But for instance, just to kind of give you an idea of what I experienced, one day, after making a cup of coffee, I sat down in the kitchen, and I looked around the kitchen, and I found that I had started and stopped making a cup of coffee 3 times before I was successful at completing it and sitting down to drink a cup of coffee. I had no memory of any previous attempts to make a cup of coffee. I was unable to make any meals. I can't even make a cup of coffee successfully the first time or second time around. I was extremely blessed in that my family and close friends brought meals and fed us really for the next month. 3 to 4 times a week, they would bring meals into the house. All I had to do was serve it, and then my kids cleaned up. I found it very difficult to leave the house to complete normal activities. This happened not too long before Christmas, and I really wanted to go grocery shopping for my family. So I was unable to drive, so I got a friend who would take me to the store or take me to the mall. And I planned as much as I could. I wrote down what I was going to get, what stores I was going to go to, and planned each item very, very carefully. And this took a week for me to plan this, like gradually through the week, because I knew on Friday afternoon I was going to go. But I remember being frightened of being overwhelmed with the visual stimulus and getting short-term memory losses. I was very concerned at the real possibility I would find myself in a store, overwhelmed, and not know where I was or how to seek help. It happened a lot at home. I know that everybody has an experience where they walk into a room and say, oh, no, what did I come in here for? But it was like a very real experience for me, in that I would go through the house and I wouldn't know where I was going and what I was planning to do. But I felt safe in my house. Going out shopping was another matter. When I did start working, I was not able to work on the computer for more than just a few minutes at a time, and I had to take a break. Email is a primary communication tool at work, and I could only respond to a few emails at a time before I could take a break. Communicating face-to-face was challenging. I had to take copious notes to remember enough of the conversation, and even when I was writing that down, it was draining my mental ability. and was impacting my visual challenges. I couldn't focus very well. The fact that I wasn't focusing kind of put my brain in overdrive and would drain all of the energy I had, and I'd have to take a break and be quiet in a dark spot for a while. During my recovery and transition back into normal functions, my progress plateaued because of the visual problems. And I was only able to work 4 to 6 hours per day. I couldn't go beyond that because I received so much visual stimulation, my brain would just stop. And then I would have short-term memory problems and all of those other symptoms would return. Once I was able to overcome the visual challenges, I was able to increase my work, increase my mental exertion. All the things that I had taken for granted and even complained about occasionally were treasured. All of a sudden, I was able to get this. I was excited because I could do laundry. I could get it organized, and I could wash, and I could dry, fold, and put away. To me, that was like a major thing. And if you look at it from the perspective, I had a relatively minor accident, but it completely flipped my life. And if I hadn't had the resources that were available at HCMC, I'm not exactly sure how I would have progressed and how I would have gotten better. It was through the therapy that I received there and even the understanding that there's something physically wrong with my brain and I'm not just depressed. I really want to thank you for the opportunity to share my story because, you know, my story is not unique. Those statistics are out there, and there's a lot of people out there that aren't getting help. And they're struggling through. They don't know what's wrong. Because the thing is, if there's something wrong with your brain, you don't know it. If you have short-term memory loss, you don't know what you don't remember. And so having the resources available and that support and to get me through that was key to me being where I am today.
Thank you, Ms. Brown. Thank you very much. There may be opportunity for questions if you'll allow that a little later, but there are some other testifiers who would like to approach the table. Would both Rick Cardenas and Nicole Villavincenzio please approach the table?
Madam Chair and members of the committee. Oh, we're waiting for Vicki, you come up.
Nicole, did I say your name right?
It's Nicole Villavicencio.
Villavicencio, thank you very much. Are you going to begin, Rick? Yes, please say your name and orient us to who you are before your testimony.
Okay, Madam Chair and members of the committee, I'm Rick Cardenas, and thanks for the opportunity to speak today. I'm representing myself, or I'm here often with representing another organization that I work for. And my questions, about the bill, and it's the amount of money that is going in to support this bill. I don't find the idea of cure or spinal cord research or stem cell research necessarily on a continuum with services and community-based services that this committee may look at in the future. I know it was somewhat addressed, and I find that the public and many members of the legislature and Senate do not differentiate from one disability from another disability. I think inherent in this bill, even looking at spinal cord and traumatic brain injury, there is still a differentiation between those two injuries and the rehab services that might be necessitated for becoming a broader functioning person within the community, within society. One of the things that I do is do leadership development for persons with intellectual and developmental disabilities, and one of the things that is of strong interest, of course, is jobs. Another is transportation, and then housing, not necessarily housing within the city, but in more rural areas. The idea of a cure for that or other disabilities is never there. Individuals are there trying to function daily within society and their community. So, again, as although I don't see them on a continuum, I do see them continuum because, again, it's services for persons with disabilities, and that can use individuals of the public. I think that once someone has survived an injury for a year or 2 year and getting on with their life, they begin to see it differently, and often when a high-profile person is injured, like Christopher Reeve or Nick Bonacotti, there's a push for spinal cord research. And I think that it's a positive thing from the NIH level, where NIH, National Institute of Health, is spending millions of dollars on spinal cord research. I don't know what this $1 billion is going to do in the scheme of the $100 million annually on spinal cord research on a national level. Here it sounds as if it will provide employment for young researchers and clinicians and probably the person that has to take care of the rats and the mice in that research. But for the disability community, it is not going to provide new job coach, transportation, or housing for individuals who are living with disabilities right now.
Thank you. Thank you. Please introduce yourself and orient us to where you come from.
Okay. Again, my name is Nicole Villavicencio, and thank you, Chair Sharon and committee members for letting me speak today. I wear many hats, but today I'm just representing myself. And as myself, I am a member of the disability community as a whole. I have a partner who is also a person with a disability, and I also have a 10-month-old daughter. So I'm an active member of the whole community. And I guess I'm here just to express shortly that, you know, like one of the things that I do is I teach self-advocacy to other people with disabilities, usually from the ages of 14 to into the end of their 20s. And basically, the result of that is to teach them to be more independent and to hopefully live without, you know, the supports that the state funds. So less of the support, so they can be more independent on their own. And so, you know, when I heard of this bill and I seen that, you know, hopefully it would fund the 75 to 80 researchers, the first thing that comes into my mind is I would love to see 75 to 80 people with disabilities leading the disability community and teaching others with disabilities how to be more independent and how to live the life that they would like to live as best as they possibly can. So one of the things that also comes into my mind as well is that, you know, for instance, the STAR program is a great program that has been funded by the state, but I've seen its money depleted year after year. And if you're not familiar with that program, it funds assistive technology for people with disabilities, and it's a great program that's helped many people. And I just think that in the community as a whole, that $8 million what could we be doing with it, and as for the better of the whole community. And not that I'm against the research at all, in general. I just think that, like, for instance, the shoestring budgets that, like, for instance, Rick and I help with people with disabilities could possibly be assisted as well.
Thank you. Thank you, Ms. Villavicencio. Did you pretty good? Thank you. We just have received a request from Jean Lee to testify on this bill. And then I'd like to reserve some time here for the committee to discuss. So if you could please focus your comments on the bill. Thank you.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, thank you. I'm Jean Lee, President and Executive Director of Children's Hope International R&R Family Centers. I do work with another organization, but speaking specifically to the issues here in the bill. My background has previously been a corporate auditor for Fortune 500 companies. I've been grant reviewers, but I also suffered from a head injury from an assault, and also, which wasn't treated, and I have also had falls, and I can't say particularly I've had the kind of spinal injuries that some of these other people have had. But I do recognize some of the symptoms as far as vision loss, speech, and memory loss. And with vision, I apologize for walking to men's bathrooms because I can't see the sign very well, but I didn't really see anything. Anyway, I did want to mention, as far as involvement of other entities and people who are essential for, if we are going to make progress as far as treatment and in research, one of them has been the effort sponsored by Vice President Mondale, and he's working with Europe on the brain injury section. The other is the Veterans Administration, or the hospital over at Fort Snelling. They are a leader in the nation as far as doing research in this area. And I'd like to see them also at the table. Also at the table should be community organizations and people affected, more so than is on the so-called advisory list. I shouldn't say so-called. On the advisory list as far as being named. And I do want to say that I have sat in on evaluating research papers done by university medical students and so forth, and some of them are pretty bad. So I'd be concerned about, and other people there reviewing them would be concerned about, if money was being spent on some of the things that they come up with. So with that in mind, you know, those are some of the things to consider. Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Ms. Lee. Okay, seeing no further testifiers come before us, I'll now open it for discussion and questions from the members of the committee. For Senator Hayden. Senator Benson.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Senator Hayden. And this is in no way reflective of how I'm going to vote on this bill, but I just want to ask a few questions. You mentioned the bill says, page 1, line 13, publicly funded research institutions. Would this be limited to just Minnesota research institutions? Could it reach broadly? And if it's just Minnesota, approximately how many are there?
Madam Chair, Senator Benson, the intent would be Minnesota-based institutions. I guess I could look at Ms. Kavnarda, figure out if there's any precedence for that. That was the spirit of it. If we need to close that in, that would be.
And Madam Chair and Senator
Hayden, Benson,
we had a little trouble with an energy fund that was kind of being spread around. And so if it's Minnesota dollars, we should consider as a policy if it's going to be Minnesota research. So if Ms. Kavanaugh has a recommendation.
Madam Chair and members, it is state dollars. The commissioner would be the one awarding the grant, so presumably they would give it to a Minnesota institution, but I don't see any reason why on line 13 you couldn't add to Minnesota or publicly funded research Minnesota institutions. Mm-hmm. Minnesota that helps you? Or Minnesota
or research.
Research Minnesota research institutions?
If Senator Hayden is amenable to that, if we could get some advice from a testifier.
Yeah, Madam Chair, Senator Benson, I would be amenable to that. And I
Dr. Roxwell, would you like to speak to that briefly? This is an amendment that indicates that the program would award grants to Minnesota public funded research.
In terms of the numbers?
What the amendment does is that the grant program awards grants to Minnesota publicly funded to publicly funded Minnesota research institutions.
Madam Chair,
it limits it to Minnesota research institutions.
Madam Chair, I know that I brought Dr. Russell also to answer the second half of Senator Benson. So if we go with I don't know if he needs to answer the amendment. I'm comfortable with that, but then she also asked the kind of who is doing it in the public realm.
Did you want to speak to this amendment? Is this an amendment that you want to offer, Senator Benson?
Madam Chair, and I think we might be getting a little advice on perhaps Minnesota-based institutions. There was a little conversation. Senator Marty, if you could help.
Madam Chair, I just wondered,
Senator Marty?
Just hearing people stumbling over the language, is instead after institutions, insert in Minnesota.
Thank you. And so,
Minnesota. Okay.
Madam Chair, if I may.
Yes, Senator Benson.
I would move the oral amendment on page 1, line 13. After the word institutions, insert in Minnesota.
Senator Benson moves an amendment on line 1.13 to insert in Minnesota following institutions. Is there any further discussion? Senator Hayden, do you wish to speak to the amendment?
Good. Well, thank you, Madam Chair. No, I think that is appropriate. That's the spirit of the bill, is to have it used in Minnesota.
Any further discussion? All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Seeing none. Passes. Further questions? Senator Marty, and then Senator Hoffman.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, I have not been tracking this closely. I'm aware of it and so on. The $4 million a year for 2 years, is there expectation? I mean, one of the witnesses talked about how many hundreds of millions there are nationally in research. Is there an expectation that this is getting us, that we may be getting really close here? I mean, I'm just curious how the $4 million was picked, that sort of thing.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, thank you for your question. We kind of bounced around numbers a little bit, and part of what $4 million per year we knew it was about 70, or as in the letter from Dr. Parr and Dr. Lowe, who couldn't be here today, who I worked pretty closely along with Dr. Roxwald on this bill. We thought that was a number we landed upon. We knew that would also be contingent upon things that kind of go on around here, our targets and others. So, but we knew that number could kind of get us there. And in particular, Dr. Parr spoke about the work and some of the how close she feels like. And, I'm not a researcher nor a doctor, but how close she was to getting some of these therapies closer to working well. So the number, and I know we have to go through a finance committee as well, is probably pretty well open, but we know we needed to start somewhere, and we knew that this number got us about that many researchers, which got us then closer, along with the other funding sources that they're working with. Dr. Roxwell.
Madam Chair.
Yes, Dr. Roxwell.
Yes. I briefly spoke to that issue. I think what I was saying is that this preliminary data and these pilot projects don't necessarily have to be huge amounts of money. I mean, sometimes $100,000 is enough to get somebody on the path. To run a randomized clinical trial is like $25 million. And that's where you move into, federal NIH Department of Defense funding. I would see this fund as funding smaller, innovative projects and stimulating interest in this area. You just never know what kind of an idea is going to lead to something. And I'm sure that NIH sometimes turns down the best ideas.
Thank you. Ma'am. Senator Marty, follow-up, and then Senator Hoffman, I think you had a question.
Madam Chair, Doctor, in other words, we're not on, I want to know how we're, this is not on the verge of a cure. This is, we're looking for new, this stem cell therapy has real promise, and this may be a catalyst not only to get more research money, but also to make a breakthrough. The reason I ask is because I think we have to be sensitive to other things. I don't want to pit this against something else, but the reality around here is things often do get pitted against that. So the $4 million will, among other things, I got the sense from this letter, will bring in more research dollars. But you're not expecting 3-5 years from now we're going to have, quote, a cure?
Well, the $4 million is not going to lead to the cure, but it's going to help move the process forward and develop ideas and further work with stem cells and so forth that will make a difference. And, I don't think anybody can predict, when the cure is going to happen, but that's certainly a worthy goal.
Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden, it's great to have this conversation. And knowing that the amount of traumatic brain injury and spinal cord injuries occur yearly and the net result and how much that is over a long period of time is kind of overwhelming. And seeing the progress that certain segments and pockets of our medical world is doing in order to address the issues, I think it's commendable that you want to try to collaborate something together. And I really like the idea of the group of kind of your best practice group collaborating, because what the Mayo is doing and what the university are doing, a lot of times they're not talking to one another. I know that. And having, seeing the results of what neurogenic bladders can do to folks and kidney problems that exist, I think it's also advantageous for us to take a broader look at this and look at neural tube defects in general, and not just segment it for spinal cord injury, but also look at some of the rewarding work that's doing with folks that might have spina bifida or might have some kind of a neural tube defect. And so I'd like to see that. When you talked about casting a wider net, Doctor, I really like that, because you talked about the rehabilitative model, but there's also a habilitative model that our friends are bringing up too, and I think somehow that has to be coordinated and collaborated together. But I'd like to see the broader stroke added in there about neurotube disorders or neurotube defects as well, which is a spinal cord injury.
Senator Hayden, would you like to respond?
Well, great, Madam Chair. Senator Hoffman, I think you're right. I'm not an expert by far on this issue. I've been learning an awful lot over the last year. I know people like yourself and others who have been either working on this or come from that community really understand this in a way that's much greater than my own capacity. So I'm willing and more than willing to work on the language, the makeup of the committee, and looking at other neural conditions to, ensure that we are doing really great work. I think that's something that we want to move towards. I will say, Senator Hoffman and Madam Chair, that we should, look at those issues that are directly related to what the bill wants to do, that if we start to take this particular piece of legislation and cast it too far, then I think that we get into a situation often around here as well, to Senator Marty's point about not only pitting, but just doing a little bit for everybody and not really getting any critical mass to move forward to where we want to go. And so that doesn't speak to if we should work on the neural tube or other issues, but I want the members to consider, as we think about this issue, how do we do this in a way that it can be most effective. And with that being said, Madam Chair, also just want to address the issue of this pitting, and I am work closely with Rick and with Nikki on a lot of issues, as well as the communities that they represent. And I don't want this bill to become a linchpin, if you will, of pitting saying one versus the other. And I know that, unfortunately, because our resources are thin, that sometimes happens. I'm hoping that we can do this in a way that allows the continued funding of people living and working in the community and growing that if that's what is required, but also taking a really good look at the work that we're trying to do here so that we can offer some promise for a cure or at least for much more mobility and movement than what a lot has today.
A follow-up, Senator Hoffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you, Senator Hayden. What I was hoping is, let me clarify that, is a neural tube disorder in the case of a spinal cord injury, it becomes a neural tube, you know, condition. And I think if we're looking at the neural tube conditions and we're looking at that, I think we should not rule out that might happen because of, and if the research is there and you find something that's going to help somebody with cerebral palsy or somebody's going to have that, by all means, this is a great opportunity, I think, for us to step because NIH, it's sad to see the research dollars going away, and that's just part of what the rule is. It falls on us. So I'm very supportive of this, Senator Hayden. I just hope that stroke wasn't very broad, but really let's be real in there on the neural tube side.
Absolutely.
Thank you.
Madam Chair, Senator Hoffman, he clearly understands this issue, and I'd be more than glad to work with him as this bill progresses, if it is the committee's pleasure.
Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden, thank you for bringing this bill today. It's a critical bill, and I want to specifically thank Gabe for sharing your story with us and the need, and your father for talking about pluripotent stem cells and really the cutting edge I think we're on in regenerative medicine. We've already seen heart valves from pluripotent stem cells. So regenerative medicine is happening today, and it's very exciting. And we are a global leader in healthcare research in this state. And we've got the genomic partnership between Mayo Clinic and the University of Minnesota that has done great things in the genomic research. And that partnership was formed 10 years ago, and they've had great results. And I, not having a medical background, but I see regenerative medicine as the next step. And we're there. So I want to thank you for bringing this bill. And to the good doctor's point about hoping this casts a wide net for proposals, that we get a lot of great research proposals, I have an oral amendment, which I think Senator Hayden hopefully will look at as a friendly amendment, and I would like to offer that now, Madam Chair.
Yes, Senator Nelson.
On line 1.3, strike the words publicly funded research after the word in Minnesota, which we added in Senator Benson's oral amendment. Add these words, performing publicly funded research, and on page 2, line 2.3, strike the word and, put in a or a. Strike the word 8, put in 9. And lastly, after 2.5, line 2.5, insert one member representing the Mayo Medical School. And I can read that back, Madam Chair, if there is a need.
I think Senator Nelson moves that on page 1, line 1.13, that publicly funded research, the language publicly funded research, be deleted, and on line 1.12 or on 1.13, after institutions, include in Minnesota performing publicly funded research. On page 2, line 2.3, eliminate an and replace with a. 9, eliminate 8 and replace with 9. And add under after line 2.5 between numbers 1 and 2, reordering Mayo Medical School, one member representing Mayo Medical School.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Hayden. Senator Nelson, I think that's a great idea. There are great relationships that are going on between the university and the Mayo, and we would not want to have one of our great medical institutions not be involved with this because they already are, so I'm comfortable with the amendment.
Any further discussion on the amendment? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
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 Opposed? The amendment passes. Thank you very much. Is there any further discussion? Senator Martin.
Madam Chair, Senator Hayden, the advisory group, you removed the sunset that would automatically appear there. I guess my only question for that is, supposing this legislation passes and there's a $8 million or some two-year commitment of funding, and then 2 years from now there will be a request for funding again and so on. But assuming the funding does not continue at some point, do you want the advisory committee to continue indefinitely? Or I'm just curious why you chose to leave it, to exempt it from the sunset. And I don't know, was just going to check when the sunset would shut it down otherwise.
Well, thank you, Senator, Madam Chair, Senator Marty. You know, I don't have a particular reason other than I would hope that the if this bill was successful and the appropriation would come, that we would have that group continue, the group of experts and leaders continue to meet, and just kind of pulled it out of that process. If it's your pleasure or if it's the committee's pleasure to tie it to that, that's it's not a sticking point to me. It's just that I would hope that the work that we would do and that would result from this would continue, and that we would continue, if so, and it was the legislature and the committee's pleasure, continue to fund it. And so that was just kind of the thought.
Senator Marty, our understanding of the language is that we would assume that this would be continued funding, that this would go into the base. The language here does not indicate that it would require reauthorization after this biennium. If there is a desire to review this, the language would have to indicate that.
So, Madam Chair,
Senator Marty,
Senate Counsel, or Fiscal Analyst, or whomever, this is an ongoing appropriation for whatever amount Finance Committee puts into it.
Madam Chair and Senator Marty, that's correct, unless we want to say this is a one-time appropriation, and that might happen when we, as it goes down the road here. And if that's the case, then we could certainly look at the advisory committee and how long that would stick around.
Madam Chair, I'm not trying to change that. I'm just asking because I assumed it was 2 years, but it is ongoing.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it is. Senator Hayden, I had some of the same questions that others were asking. It's not one-time funding. Can you tell me, in terms of the policy discussion about this, without talking about traumatic brain injury or spinal cord injury research, what we're talking about here is the state engaging in a role of providing grants for research. Mm-hmm. As Senator Hoffman indicated, there could be many, many other very important and needed areas for research. So can you tell me, and maybe you would not be able to answer this now, but I would clearly like to know, if we have precedents for establishing grants that are ongoing in the base directed towards a specific research, this would be $2 million per year for brain injury, traumatic brain injury, and $2 million for spinal cord injury. It's divided half and half, and it's in the base. So my question is, what is the precedence here? What are we doing overall in terms of, are we moving the state into a funding role that and source that's new as opposed to the already traditional funding sources for research?
So, Madam Chair and committee members, we did do some research, and we could continue to do it. What I was able to find was that there was, in 1985, we appropriated money to the University of Minnesota for Alzheimer's disease research. And so there may be other allocations, and we're still looking for those. But in my notes and some of the research that we were able to do, we knew that that had been done before. But with that being said, I know that precedence is important, but also I think the work that we're trying to do, even if it sets a precedence, is pretty important. And so, you know, I do think that this is, you know, different and something that we, you know, don't do a lot if this is the only time we've done it. But I think that it is important enough, and to have this very thoughtful conversation about if this is something that we should do. I think that the physicians and others, the advocates, have talked about some of the work that is being done. And so I would hope that the committee would find, at least from a policy perspective, that this would be a good ideal. And then we can start to work on the makeup of the boards as well as the dollars that could be available in the next committees.
Thank you, Senator Hayden. I'm just articulating that question because that discussion about what we're doing as a state in terms of defining or broadening our role for funding in the area of research, not arguing about its necessity,
right,
but expanding that role and opening that door, if that's what's happening, is something that I have to think about for support of this idea. That's the underlying question for me. Any other discussion?
And
Senator Benson.
Madam Chair and Senator Hayden, before we did the last amendment, I had significant concern about the size of this advisory committee. I would like to work with you offline to talk about tightening it up, if that's something that you're open to. So I'll try to squeeze in some time on your calendar. The specific question right now is page 1, line 17. We talk about half the grant funds for spinal cord, half to traumatic brain injury. In addition to being very specific in pulling research dollars out of the general fund, and we're being very specific about the University of Minnesota, can you please tell us your thinking on the half and half split? Did you consider leaving it open and flexible so the advisory committee could find the most forthcoming promising research and fund that? I just would like to know where the half and half split came from.
Senator Hayden.
Sure, Madam Chair, Senator Benson. As you develop these bills and you bring in all of the kind of stakeholders and physicians, advocates and others, we were just trying to create a balance because we didn't want to we didn't want to pick one over the other. And so, you know, we would hope, and I'm open for it to be flexible, but I was really leaning on people like Dr. Roxwell and others who have a really, and I don't mean to put him on the spot, but who really, you know, have spent a career and a lifetime working on these issues on both sides of this, as well as, you know, the tension inside, and you felt a little bit of that today between the kind of rehab and moving forward versus the research. Well, there's always tension even in the research community, and so this was a way of trying to forge some sort of agreement to move forward and get some consensus on even bringing it forward today.
Thank you. All right. Doctor, did you want to say something?
I was just going to comment that you could, a balance would be rather than a straight 50-50, you could move it like 40-60, and you know, I think there would be various options.
Madam Chair, I'm just reticent to suggest a specific number. You're doing it to be respectful of the two communities that are coming forward in this bill. I just get concerned about how much we tie the hands of some of these boards, but we'll have an offline discussion, and
absolutely,
if you like my ideas, they'll end up in the bill next time. Thanks.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Benson, I'll be more than willing to work with you on this bill.
Senator Marty.
Madam Chair, I was kind of agreeing with Senator Benson's concerns about, I don't know, but $2 million in terms of this kind of research, it strikes me that, you know, if one's a little more promising than another in the grants that you have, it seems to me that the commissioner, if she's consulting with this, or he is consulting with this task force, which has people from both sides, I'd much rather leave it, and again, this is probably a finance committee jurisdiction issue, but I'd much rather have a little more flexibility if we're giving these kind of grants instead of $2 million a year or whatever numbers come up with a year for each one. And I don't think we should be picking 40, 60, or 50-50. I'll leave that for the next committee, but I think Senator Benson's concerns are well put.
Okay. Thank you, Senator Marty. There are questions for the next committee, obviously, Senator Hayden. Seeing no further discussion, the question is on the motion of Senator Hayden that Senate File 111, as amended, be recommended to pass and referred to state and local government. Is that correct, Senator Hayden?
Madam Chair, that is correct.
Yes, thank you very much. Is there any further discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Bill passes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members.
And being no further business before this committee, we are adjourned.